Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Podcast. Today is Thursday, January 31st, 2019. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and ask you to subscribe. $19.95 for a digital subscription, $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine, in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, fresh from 2 days of controversy on Morning Joe surrounding his hot new book, Unjust, Noah Rothman, associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
He's so tired. He's so tired of spending an hour talking about his book on television, on national television. Next to me, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, 24 hours before her official coming on board as senior writer at Commentary, Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Okay, so the political news of the week seems to be the candidacy of Howard Schultz, the supposed independent, possible, considering seriously the independent bid for the presidency. And I think it's safe to say that mainstream media and from mainstream media to the left, or am I being redundant, has had a cow for 72 hours at the very prospect of Schultz being in the race at all, on the grounds that he will, you know, hand the presidency to Trump if he runs as a third party candidate. Shoes on the other foot here, because in 1992, 1996, and even in 2000, there were such fears connected to Pat Buchanan and Ross Perot among Republicans. Perot arguably did hand the presidency to Bill Clinton, though Pat Buchanan arguably handed the presidency to George W. Bush, not through any act of his own, but through the design of the butterfly ballot in Palm Beach County, right? So that was just the 3,000 elderly Jews voting for Pat Buchanan thing that remains one of the great savage ironies of our time. Anyway, so there is precedent for third-party spoilers. And then, of course, 2016, where 6% of the vote went to third-party candidates. That's Gary Johnson and Jill Stein, and it certainly had some effect on, and Ralph Nader in 2000 also taking votes away from Al Gore. So anyway you slice it, third parties can be dangerous to the aspirations of the party that seems to align more clearly with their predilections than the opposite party. And there's a lot of glee on the right. Like, if you look at the Wall Street Journal editorial page today, there's all this: why are Democrats so afraid of Howard Schultz? Are they afraid of having a serious conversation about healthcare spending and the debt? I mean, it looks like they're kind of scared. You know, Howard Schultz is bringing up issues that the Democrats don't want to talk about. This strikes me as a little similar to the glee with which mainstream media and the left elevated Rand Paul in 2013 and 2014. Rand Paul is raising issues in the Republican Party about imperial overstretch and blah, blah, blah.
It's more similar to me to the reaction from some too clever by half quarters of the Democratic opinion commentariat in their response to Donald Trump early on in the Republican primary, because he was going to both render the Republican Party unelectable, and he was serving a very important role in, while demonstrating that the Republican Party was antediluvian in its racial views, but also he was really friendly to concepts like keeping the social safety net intact, and he didn't favor repealing the individual mandate.
And so he didn't like Republican foreign policy.
So people like Jonathan Chait and Matt Iglesias were very coyly saying, you know, well, the person you should really fear is Marco Rubio. His presidency would be absolutely horrific. Yeah. Donald Trump is not the biggest threat in this race.
Yes.
And it was all, you know, political positioning.
Cutesy. And well, it's very cutesy, adorable, right? You know, like, trolling, laughing in your hands. And some of this really is trolling on the part of the right. Because if you really think that Howard Schultz talking about the debt is that the debt is going to be an issue that is going to worry moderate Democratic vote, or you know, is going to really have an effect on the Democratic primary, you are living in a dream world, and they know that.
But his reluctance to be a mouthpiece for the class warfare stuff on the left, I think, is actually important. Not in that it'll change any minds on the left, but that I think it forces them to have to defend those positions.
No, that's that's a really good point, though. And in fact, he's said that himself several times, right? He said the Democratic Party. I won't run as a Democrat. That would be disingenuous. The party shifted too far to the left, and he cites all the big things that the flavor of the moment, you know, progressives are touting, like universal free health care, guaranteed jobs, free college. He's actually holding his own side to account, and I think that, I mean, that's why the best they have is to like gotcha him on questions of how totally. Much a box of Cheerios costs. I mean, I think they are a little nervous about this.
But there is a constituency for that sort of thing on the Democratic Party. I mean, it's just that no one is servicing it. There is a constituency that is for fiscal responsibility, less so than the Republican Party, and no one's talking about these issues on either side of the aisle, but there is a constituency that he's serving, and to the extent that, I mean, I don't think it's so much as a spoiler, but it's also the fact that he's irritating Democrats by only attacking Democrats. I mean, people have said, well, how centrist are you? The only thing you've done is criticize Democrats.
Okay.
And Trump.
There are two things that I really enjoyed. I mean, there are two things I will confess to enjoying, which is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez saying, these billionaires, what do they know about, you know, the life of real people? And Howard Schultz, whom I have many problems with, grew up in projects in Canarsie and had a father who was a bus driver and a truck driver who beat him up as a kid. And, you know, was the first person in his family to attend college. And so he is literally an American, pull yourself up by the bootstraps success story. He took a small coffee shop basically in Seattle and turned it into a massive, you know, global multi-billion dollar business. So, you know, did he do that all himself? Yes, he did. And so, you know, that's a foolish line of argument. It's actually the first, I would say, successful. It's the first thing that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has done, aside from her making mistakes and stuff, which I don't think really hurt her. That really does suggest she, you know, she doesn't understand that she needs to bone up a little bit on these things before she goes out and starts, you know, making, you know, illiterate attacks on people without just sort of reading their Wikipedia entries for 10 seconds, you know. So I enjoy that. That was good. And it's fun to see how, you know, a guy go on Stephen Colbert and say that, you know, socialized healthcare is un-American. Like, it's striking. When was the last time anybody said anything was un-American on Colbert that wasn't related to Trump?
That's also part of how the socialized, I mean, instead of a digression, but the Medicare for All little boomlet on the Democratic left engaged with a skeptical electorate for the first time this week and blew up on the tarmac.
I don't know that it blew up on that. I know there are arguments to be said that, you know, that when Kamala Harris said she's done with private health care, and then, you know, Michael Bloomberg, the other billionaire in the race or whatever, said, you know, look, if you want to destroy America by going this route, we could look like Venezuela if you want. That's, like I say, that's like, that's music to, that's fun. We're sitting there going, oh, thank God.
But it's not us who's saying it's so great. It's a critical mass of Democrats in the Senate caucus who said, oh, no, I'm not on board with this, which has been a part of feature of Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan for 3 years that everybody knew was there, who decided to look it more than skin deep into the plan. All of a sudden they say, oh my gosh, I had no idea. That's horrible. We can't do that.
Okay, so, you know, years ago, I don't remember even when it was. Maybe it was 2010, 2011. Tevi Troy did a big piece for Commentary on how people misunderstand healthcare as a political issue. Healthcare has been devastating, had been, he said, devastating to Democrats in every major election that where healthcare, after 1992, where healthcare played a role. In 94, in 2000, in 2008, and in 2010. That the promise, the Democrats thinking that healthcare is such a popular issue that they should hammer it home, was really going to help them, had turned out not to be true. And arguably, you could say that about 2016, I think, in that Hillary Clinton also thought somehow that because Republicans were bad on health, or they were afraid to talk about health care in 2016, right? That was actually the story they were afraid to talk about in 2016. But 2018, they won 40 seats. So now it's all changed. And now not only don't they, so they don't have to defend.
So many Democratic candidates were on board with Medicare
for all, but they don't have to defend Obamacare, which if they jump
they're
to.
They're attacking Obamacare. Right, this is the perverse reality. Republicans are going to be forced to defend Obamacare.
Right.
Now.
If they've jumped beyond Obamacare to Medicare for all, then that raises two interesting questions politically. So there's the Howard Schultz, there's the you people are all crazy. And this is not the way you're going to either get elected, or it's not going to happen, or it's bad, right? And then there's, what's the matter? We passed Obamacare. It needs to be fixed up because the funding mechanism is all screwed up now. But, you know, it took people off the roll. It put people on the rolls. More people have insurance, blah, 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 right? And that's Biden, right? What is Biden, if Joe Biden gets in the race? He's got to defend Obamacare. And what if that turns out to be the moderate Democratic position here?
Well, he's not going to have a problem doing that. He's already.
I'm not saying he is. I'm saying maybe because because Kamala Harris has now established Medicare for all as a baseline and opposition to private insurance, even though she's backed off it a little bit in the last couple of days. This then makes Obamacare the prudent, moderate position.
Well, here's the thing is that, and we said this in the pre-show, that James Pindell is a reporter who posited an interesting theory yesterday, and that is that the front runner in the race for the Democratic nomination in 2020 is Mike Bloomberg. Not because anybody likes him, but because he is the only candidate in a race clogged with progressive aspirants who have all signed on to this variety of progressive positions, Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, what have you. And he is the only person who occupies a more centrist lane. And that centrist lane, if it has the appeal of maybe 20%, 25% of the Democratic electorate, could prevail as long as it maintains that 25%, a la Donald Trump, who got about 30% over the course of an entire year because the whole race was clogged with conservatives. So they were all splitting up the vote. Similar dynamic might prevail with Democrats.
By the way, that's another humorous thing about the attack on Schultz is that they say, well, you don't want to pick a part. You don't want to be a Democrat because you know that you can't sell your agenda to Democrats, right? So you just want to buy your way into the end game. They don't want him as a Democrat because he would occupy the place that the lane all to himself, as Noah's talking about.
Well, and it's also, I've been reading Noah's amazing book, so I know that one of the other things...
Unjust, now available on Amazon.
Yes. Unjust, it's available, you should buy it.
And Barnes & Noble, and your local bookstore.
Well, here's what I've learned from reading Noah's excellent book, is that one of the interesting things, we were talking about Schultz's background. John, you said earlier, and correctly, that, you know, first to go to college, he has a really good up-by-his-bootstrap story, but this is another aspect that... of the Democratic Party that's changed in recent years, which is that if you're a white male, you don't get to use your bootstrap story anymore, right? I mean, I think the progressive wing would say he's still a white man, he still had privilege even if he was coming out of the projects and, you know, had a tough childhood. So I think that's another example where I think Noah's right, that we're seeing a lot of internal party turmoil among the Democrats that, although on different issues, is similar to what the Republicans have been going through under Trump. And look, I mean, Schultz's instincts are certainly questionable. I mean, remember his reaction to the arrest of the two African-American patrons in a Philadelphia Starbucks. You know, he shut down all Starbucks stores and everybody had to have a kind of, you know, group therapy session. I mean, so he's a little wacky. Let's posit that. But I do think that it's fascinating to watch him roil internal party dynamics as they try to figure out just how far to the left they're going to move for the next election.
I mean, I hate to be blunt and vulgar about this, but Schultz is also not allowed to have a up from your bootstrap story because he's Jewish. And if you actually dig down, and what people will say as this goes on is, well, you know, he may have been, you know, he had white privilege also because he was Jewish. He had special white privilege because, you know, Jews are so serious about education and they're so interested in their, they have a cultural background that emphasizes education, and that's a form of privilege and stuff like that. And you're going to hear, I mean, there's sotto voce stuff going on in the Democratic Party, Bloomberg will bring this up too if he runs. Bloomberg will be running as a rich Jewish billionaire from New York. You think in the Democratic Party today that won't be the sort of underground assault?
Oh, it's not even going to be underground. Bloomberg? I'm in. I've been doing the rounds for this thing, and the attack on my perspective is that I can't possibly share the experience that would allow me to opine on the issues I do with any authority, because I've just been privileged my whole life. And in the back of my head, I'm like, well, you know, a guy with a blindingly Jewish last name does experience bigotry in the United States. It's happened. It's just that it's not supposed to be the centerpiece of the book, but or my perspective, but that's just, it doesn't occur. It just really doesn't register.
No, but far from register, it's supposed to, right. But in his case, it will be, people go around and say, you know, as I say, underground, it'll be, you can't let this Jewish guy who wins prizes from Israel take over this party. This is a party now of progressives, of minorities, and Jews are one of the great unexamined terrible things about the whole white privilege minority thing is this notion that because Jews have been uncommonly successful in the United States, they no longer we no longer constitute a minority. When in fact, not only are we're a shrinking minority. Jews made up 4% of the population of the United States in 1950, and 2% today. So most of that is about population growth. Some of it is about out-migration, right? I mean, Jews leaving Judaism. The only minority group in America that is not allowed to be a minority group are Jews. Unless, of course, they're attacked by the alt-right, in which case they're attacked by the alt-right, so we're a terrible threat and minority. You know, that's, but I'm saying in the Democratic Party.
But then that's our fault because supposedly we supported the whole movement that brought the alt-right, to the fore.
I mean, This is a minor point on the way station, but you know I am not an admirer of Howard Schultz. I think he's a silly person and vainglorious, and the whole idea that he, a man with absolutely nothing of interest to say, thinks that he should be president of the United States. The only interesting thing that he's done in the last 3 or 4 days is draw this in his life as a public figure, is somehow to draw some line between him and the progressive left in the United States, which he, as Christine mentions, with the stuff with the, and it wasn't just the stuff at the Starbucks in Pennsylvania and the closing down of the stores, but things he's done across the years with global environmentalism and this and that, you know, quotes on the stupid coffee cups and all that. He has done nothing but cater to, understandably too, because the Starbucks brand is this kind of sort of invented millennial, you know, it was Seattle, it was grunge, it was, you know, it has that.
That was Gen X.
Right, well, Gen X onto millennials, like it has this, has a cultural stamp on it that is not, you know, hi, I'm owned by a billionaire. It's right. Like, come in, you can listen to, you know, Mexican, you know, our song of the day is an emo Mexican, you know, drumming band. Please buy the Putumayo record, you know, CD at the counter. You know, that's what Starbucks is. Not a defender of capitalism.
Well, I'm just waiting for the feminist left to finally, you know, dethrone the Starbucks mermaid because she's topless. You know, it's very objectifying, this logo that.
Oh my goodness!
Over the years.
Also, I mean, Starbucks is named after a character in Moby Dick. Think about that, Moby Dick. I was. Go on. Anyway,
no, I just think in a general way, I'm finding Schultz more and more interesting because. The Democratic Party and the left generally, they wanted these class warfare heroes. They wanted class warfare. They wanted to punish the rich. And they never thought that they would have to deal with any backlash from, with any pushback. And he's just saying, look, I was one of you, and you've lost me. And they're trying to silence that because it has to be smooth sailing all the way for their agenda without any interruptions.
Right. Now, so I was on MSNBC yesterday, not defending my book, but I was on a segment on MSNBC talking about Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax. And what struck me with the very progressive Zerlina Maxwell as my sort of counterpart, and what struck me was the presumption that was being made on the show that Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax, which is 2% over holdings, not earnings, not annual earnings, but holdings over $50 million in the United States, which startlingly, it turns out, would affect 75,000 families, which means if you think about this, the United States has generated 75,000 families with assets over $50 million. That is astounding. That fact alone is you want to look at that and say that America's terrible because of terrible economic inequality, or you want to say that America is a wealth generator unlike anything the world has ever seen, and that all we are doing right now is having debates over how to stop the wealth generation or freeze it in its tracks. Anyway, what was striking to me was that it was simply the presumption that it was fine to do this. And so I said, like, well, no, you know, income taxes are taxes on income, meaning you're taxed on the money you make during that year to help defray the cost of running the government in that year, so that the services that you get and the things that are provided to you and all of that, you help pay for to make the government a going concern. It's not to expropriate money to redistribute it. That is not what the income tax system is for. It's called an income tax, not a wealth tax. Warren is honest enough to call it a wealth tax, because the idea is, don't worry, you're not, it's them. It's these guys over here, and they can afford it, and we're telling you that they can afford it.
So can I share one thought from that segment? It's a spectacular segment. You should seek it out if you haven't seen it. It's really interesting. So the second that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez proposed her 70% marginal income tax rate, I started researching the wealth tax, because it was obvious that pretty soon people were going to figure out that was an infinitesimally tiny pool of money. The 16,000 people in the United States filed a tax return that big. Nobody's going to pay that tax. So eventually they're going to get to the wealth tax. And then you research how it works in Europe, and people move assets away. Yeah. You'd have to declare every asset you own to the IRS. So people hide assets. They offshore it. That's just human nature. And the response that you got is one I've heard a lot. Oh, so we're going to tailor our tax policy now to what rich people want?
Yeah.
No, you're going to tailor your tax policy to human nature, because people are going to evade these taxes. Elizabeth Warren says, well, we're going to find those assets. If they park, she's addressed this. We're going to find those assets somewhere. This is entirely theoretical and unconstitutional.
And besides which, we do tailor. It's not to tailor it to human nature. It's to tailor it to effectiveness. Government is supposed to be effective. And as I said on the segment, when the tax reform bill of 1986 was passed, it completely overhauled the tax system in order to prevent the creation of modes of tax sheltering that were legal because no one had made them illegal. So the idea was, yeah, well, you know what? Maybe it would be great if you could make sure that rich people didn't do this or that or the other thing. But what you need to do then is you lower the tax rate and you eliminate, so you make sure that every rich person's dollar is taxed at 28% and that they can't escape by using tax shelters, so that their dollar is taxed at 14%. So that we don't have a situation in which middle-class people are paying a higher level of taxation than rich people. That is the whole, and that's in order to make government effective. And so not to make the laws a mockery by writing laws that are easily evaded. But you're not allowed to say that either, apparently.
Well, almost half of Americans don't even pay income tax, right? I mean, this is the other thing, is that, you know, we're talking about, you know, the infinitesimal number of billionaires and these wealth taxes. But just look at, I mean, the reason that tax policy, I would argue, should be targeted at the rich is that the rich are the ones who pay the taxes. I mean, there are a large number of families who don't owe any income tax. Yes, they still have withholding and whatnot, but that's the other part of the tax debate that's so unbelievable. And I think it's also why you get as John did on his segment on MSNBC, got this weird overreaction when he mentioned the phrase middle class. Middle class has now become, you know, like a scary phrase for progressives, because it undermines their argument about basically taxing, you know, billionaires.
Right. What Christine's talking about is that someone on the segment said, well, the middle class is basically there's no middle class in America any longer. So I was like, am I taking crazy pills? What on earth are you not only according to all surveys, 51 to 53% of Americans, you know, are classified as middle class. That doesn't mean that 50% are poor, by the way. It means that another 20% are classified as higher than middle class. Right. Well, it is the middle. Therefore, by definition, the middle class will occupy a larger space than anybody else. But it's also that there are way many more people that are in the upper middle classes than ever used to be the case. But so I was thinking, well, why is it that people think that the middle class doesn't exist anymore? So one thing was said, which is that people are living paycheck to paycheck, which has to do with assuming debt, not with... You know, I mean, yeah, there was a time when Americans saved a lot more, but that's also because they were living much more frugally than they do now and believed in saving. And the inflation of the 1960s and 1970s put an end to that, because anybody who saved their money found out that, you know, their money was worth half what it was once they wanted to take it out, because it had been sitting in a savings account. Second, so there's that thing about the middle class. And the second thing about the middle class is the middle class is it doesn't exist anymore because there are way more rich people. And so, in other words, the inequality this continues to be an argument about economic inequality, which I will grant you is philosophically a difficult and complicated problem. But the idea that people are impoverished when they are in the middle class because rich people have more money than they did before, that's not what's wrong with a system that might have severe inequality. It's not the privation that is caused by the rich being richer. It is the you know, isolation of Americans living lives that have no reflection on anybody else's.
There's a third reason, but it's also not a good reason to make the claim that there's no middle class, which is that the middle class had been shrinking, didn't disappear, had been shrinking a few years ago, but for the past 2 or 3 years, it's actually been increasing across the country.
Well, and income levels.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So there was a sort of political talking point to be made a few years back about the shrinking middle class. But it doesn't apply now, and it was never about its disappearance.
Elizabeth Warren herself said when she declared for president that she was running to help the American middle class. And by the way, that's a totally sensible thing to say, because if you win the middle class, you win the election. And it oddly enough, one of the interesting openings that Trump has provided to Democrats is that the Republican Party was the party of the middle class for a long time, because the Republican Party was the, you know, party of the small businessman and someone who sort of like that. And then Trump didn't come along. This is a longer story, and I'm being very vulgar and caricaturish, but Trump came along and said, I am the tribune for the white working class that really is falling behind. And that was the core constituency of the Democratic Party for 100 years. We're poor people. I mean, that was the Democratic Party was the party of the poor. And when the poor numbered way more than when the poor were much more potent, you know, that's how you could have a weird party where you had poor Southern racist whites and poor, you know, racially aggrieved blacks in the North and the Midwest and all of that forming a coalition together to, you know, basically dominate the Congress for almost half a century and to win the presidency. I don't know. How many terms did Republicans had the presidency for 8 years between 1932 and 1968? 8 years. That's it. So That was the Democratic Party in the, you know, the Great Depression and its aftermath. It was a party of the poor, and the poor no longer. Trump took some of the poor now, and the and there aren't enough poor in the United States, weirdly enough, to get anybody elected. Which, by the way, should another be another thing that we should be celebrating about being American, you know, is that the middle class is vastly larger than the poor. What country?
That's the story of the market revolution since the late 1980s, late 70s in the case of China. Mostly the late 1980s is the market revolution all over the world, which has made people now start to whisper about the prospect of eliminating poverty. Legitimately, right. Poverty, extreme poverty is so low globally at this point that it's exceeded the wildest expectations.
Well, we have eliminated poverty in the United States under in those terms.
Extreme poverty.
And so is Western Europe. Right. I mean, meaning people who die of starvation, meaning people who, you know,
preventable diseases.
Yeah. But I mean,
exposure.
Yeah, exposure, you know, stuff like that, which, you know, doesn't, I mean, now in the United States, we have an epidemic of obesity, not starvation, right. You know. Right. Somebody said if you took someone from the 19th century and you put them, you know, in a time machine and then they landed in 2019 at, I don't know where, a dog track, right? Or like a third rate casino in Pahrump, Nevada, and you told them these are actually America's poor. A lot of these people are America's poor, and that like 2/3 of them are morbidly obese. That would be impossible for anybody to understand at any point in world history, except
you know
now.
They used but now so it's a sort of changing goalpost situation where they use the term food insecurity a lot now, which doesn't mean what you'd think
or
it means.
Or food deserts. That's the other thing, which means that there's no supermarket.
Right, 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 right. It doesn't mean that.
Which, by the way, I don't think that's not. I think that's a problem.
Sure.
I don't think that it's not a problem. It's a different. It's a weird social problem born of abundance, not, you know, and born of weird distortions in the market, not from, you know, not from food insecurity. Right. It's kind of crazy, I think. So before we get to our next topic, I have to look up our ad. So give me a second, everybody. Oh, good. It's Quip. I love doing Quip because I use Quip every day. I use Quip twice a day. That's the electric toothbrush with the bristle, with the, you know, has battery and it tells you what to do, you know, move from quadrant to quadrant over 2 minutes. Every 30 seconds it buzzes and you move. And I feel like I have, ever since I got it, I have much better, you know, dental hygiene. You know, because the sensitive sonic vibrations give me an effective clean that's gentle on my genuinely sensitive gums. It's certainly true that I brush too hard before I got the Quip. And the built-in timer, as I said, pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. Most people don't brush evenly. Multi-use cover. This is the great thing where you go on a trip and you can take the cover and stick it to the mirror. And so you have a toothbrush right there. That doesn't, you know, have to sit on the tray and you have to put a towel on it so it doesn't get gross, dirty from the thing. And it declutters your sink. It declutters my sink now at home with the mirror. And the brush heads are automatically delivered on a 3-month schedule. So you get a new brush head in the mail, you pop it on, and you have like a whole new toothbrush every 3 months. And that's only $5. So, that's why I love Quip and why over 1 million happy, healthy mouths do too. So Quip starts at just $25. Go to getquip.com/commentary right now. You can get your first refill pack for free. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/commentary. Okay, so we're going to go a little far. We're going to go a little field here and talk about a weird story that popped up on CBS News. About a woman out of Texas named Danielle Teuscher, who basically had a baby with a sperm donor. Baby's 5 years old. Northwest Cryobank was the company that supplied the sperm, and she decided to test her daughter's genome, I guess, using the 23andMe. company where you do the thing where you scrape your what I don't know.
They don't advertise, so you can say
spittle. I don't know what it is. You see. You put stuff in a tube, and if you're people like us, it comes back. You're 99% Jewish. That's all I know. So, but so she sent this in. And one of the, it appeared that there was some kind of very close match with one of the sperm donors, one of the sperm donor's relatives. And she wanted to contact the relative. And when she said, can we talk? The relative apparently contacted the company, Northwest Cryobank. The bank said that this was in violation of her contract with Cryobank. They could seek damages. And they took back four additional vials of the same sperm that Teutscher had purchased because she planned to use it to have her daughters have full genetic siblings with the same sperm donor. So she was devastated. She says she was shocked. She was crying for days. She could barely eat. I thought I was doing the thing that was in the best interest of my daughter. They made me feel like I'm a criminal. And then she said, you know, she didn't really read what she had agreed to when she signed the contract with Northwest Cryobank, who said, you are not allowed to try to contact donors. That's part of our system. If you're going to agree to, if we're going to make this transaction, you leave the donors alone. And then she said, well, I mean, I just clicked the boxes, so what did I know? And then she says, look, my daughter is an actual living, breathing, feeling human being who did not sign that contract. So basically her daughter, she is arguing, since her daughter didn't sign the contract, her daughter has a right to know who her father is as a sperm donor. Okay. So this is fascinating because this is one of the yet another one of these stories that brings us to the limits of our ethics and how science is pushing the limits of our ethics to a point where we have no moral guidance whatsoever about what to do in these cases. Christine, do you, as our resident Luddite, what do you...
Fight you for that title.
It's a fascinating case for a number of reasons. I mean, first, there's an obvious, clear-cut, legal, contractual issue here. And we won't even get into the issue of why someone who won't read a legally binding contract is then going to, you know, which is about becoming a parent, now claims she's too irresponsible to have read the contract that made her a parent. But we'll set that aside. The cryobank is absolutely within its rights to withhold for their sperm. She broke her agreement with them. She put the anonymity and privacy of a sperm donor at risk. And she's in the wrong, legally, contractually. But that's a completely separate issue from the ethical issue, right? And these, because we have an unregulated fertility industry in this country, unlike other countries, you know, in the UK, they have a lot more regulation of this sort of thing. In the US, it's a free-for-all, it's free market. And each clinic can decide for itself what its procedures are going to be. And if you participate in them, you agree to them, as she did. But the ethical issues are fascinating. And this idea that, you know, she said, for example, this clinic has stolen her future babies, you know, as if there's this right for her to be able to conceive using someone's donor sperm. She talks about her daughter's right to know her genetic heritage. But the interesting thing from a kind of bioethics perspective is that bioethicists have been arguing against, you know, rushing into genetic manipulation using IVF and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis by saying children have the right to an open future, meaning they have the right to not let their parents choose characteristics that can't be changed. But this is kind of coming at it from the other direction, right? Which is saying my child has a right to know everything about her genome and everything about her parentage, even if I've chosen to bring her into the world with donor sperm. And I think the real issue now from a practical standpoint is whether the donor sibling registry, this is a group that exists just to connect donor conceived kids with their families. And the woman who runs it has had a donor conceived child and found like 18 of his half siblings by using this DNA testing. So we know that you can track these people down, but from a practical standpoint, we have to decide if this is what we're going to do going forward, because certainly men are going to be much less likely to be anonymous sperm donors if there's a risk of them being tracked down when they don't want to be, right? We either have to treat this a little more like adoption and say people have to choose whether they agree when donating to be contacted later on, and all the responsibilities and emotional challenges that might come with it. Or we have to just decide that we're going to make all of this transparent. And if you have donor sperm, you register with a donor sibling registry so that, for example, half siblings don't end up accidentally marrying each other. There have actually been cases of this.
Yep.
So there are all these practical questions. But what I think is most important is these fertility clinics avoid the ethical questions because they're profit-making institutions that are genuinely trying to help men and women conceive children, obviously.
Right, and the reason that Northwest Cryobank is so, you know, determined on this issue is precisely that this threatens their economic model, right? It's not because they're like, this is the, you know, you're raising moral quandaries that we can't possibly answer as a small, it's like, no one's going to want to donate sperm. We're out of business. You violated the terms. We have to hit you with a 2x4 and make an example out of you so that nobody does this again to us.
Exactly. No, exactly right.
Christine, it sounds like you've thought about this in some way.
I have opinions.
I think you should. This is your first assignment for senior writer.
Abe, please share your Luddism with us now.
Okay. I've weighed all the evidence, and I'm going to now weigh in with my decision. With the wisdom of Solomon, here's what I believe. I do not fault the woman. I do not fault the woman at all for pursuing the donor in the name of figuring out what's wrong with her child. Apparently, there were health issues that to begin with her child, right? So I would have a hard time imagining that anyone would be stuck.
I think she brought that up after, though. So she and her family were doing 23andMe, and she was like, "I'm going to do Zoe too."
I thought from the story that the health issues were there first. But by the way, but hear me out. So I would have a hard time imagining that any parent would be stopped, even if they had recognized that they were violating the contract. But so then you do that. So then you pursue that route. You find a relative. You then broke the contract that you signed. I don't have sympathy for her in terms of her crying and being outraged about having to face damages and getting the other vials of sperm pulled. I mean, at that point, so what? You did this to find out who the father was. You gave it a shot and you violated the terms. That's that.
I mean, emotional distress is no reason to violate the terms of a contract. Well, right? No court is going to hear that as a legitimate.
Okay,
argument.
But
I'm not even speaking legally.
I think it goes deeper. I think what is happening here with this and these cases that started, if I remember correctly, the kind of the moral conundrum cases started with the Baby M story. Remember, which I think it's Baby M, right? Was the story of the surrogate mother who decided to keep the kid. Wasn't that it?
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Even though there was a contract, she was like, nah, I'm going to keep the baby. And that, therefore, the entire industry overhauled itself, and it became the case that if you were going to do some kind of surrogacy, the egg had to come, that you needed to find a surrogate mother who was willing to have an egg, a fertilized egg, implanted so that while she carried the child to term, she was not its biological or genetic parent, and thus would have no legal claim except for having housed the baby in her womb to being the mother. And so there was an early moment in which the entire this for-profit industry figured out how to correct for a terrible moral deficiency that it hadn't, you know, sought. But everybody's in the right here. Like the Northwest Cryobank is in the right to say you violated a contract and you're threatening not only our business but the entire way in which sperm donation and this thing that allowed you to have a baby is done, is threatened by what you're doing here. So, you know, you are doing something that is injurious to a new way of creating life. You better, you know, walk it back. The person that Danielle Teuscher contacted, the family member of the sperm donor, was totally in the right to say, wait, what the hell is this? Like, right. I didn't know that I don't have any, right. You know, I don't even know who this is. I just went to 23andMe and, you know, and to get my genetic stuff done, and now someone's emailing me saying, "Can I contact you to find out who the father of my baby is?" And in some sense, Danielle Teuscher, despite I think what is a kind of nauseating sense of entitlement, and also this notion somehow that because she wants something, she just should get it. She's also sort of in the right in when she says that her daughter didn't sign the contract. Like, her daughter came into existence, and most until the 20th century, you know, until the late 20th century, everybody kind of knew who their father was, or, you know, some person who could be claimed to be their father. And now suddenly there's a whole class of people who come into existence without any paternity except genetically. And that's kind of horrifying. And you understand the notion that, well, if my child deserves any, she didn't pick. She should get to know who her father is. But her father did this, you know, basically, you know, went in a room, put sperm in a cup for $100. And the whole deal was, going to give you a little money. And what happens after that is not your concern. You know, there could be 1,000 children that come from your sperm donation or none, and you're never going to know, and it's not. But you knew that this was going to happen.
Well, and there's an interesting thing, right? Because most of these sperm clinics will tell the donor, you know, we're going to give you anonymity and you're free from any responsibility for this child, right? But the state has different rules. In some states, if you are the biological parent of a child, you might be obligated to pay child support for that child, even if you're didn't know they existed or weren't raising them. So what these private clinics can guarantee is not what the law actually always covers. The second thing is that I don't think there's a fertility clinic anywhere that doesn't have a caveat for women seeking sperm donors that they cannot guarantee the genetic health of the sperm. They will not guarantee that there's not a risk of disease or genetically compromised sperm. So if you go that route, if you choose to be a single parent who uses sperm donation, that is one of the risks. And there are risks with parenthood in any form you pursue it, right? So I think that's why I might sound like I'm being kind of harsh on this particular woman, but she is an adult who chose to parent in this way, and that's great, but there are risks to all avenues of parenting, and this is one of the ones with the route she chooses.
Imagine how the courts are going to have to adjudicate the three genetic parent children.
Exactly.
I mean, you can't even, I mean, so.
Which is like a year or two down the road.
The one thing that occurred to me is that this shows the genius of the Jewish process of the oral law that has come to be known, the Talmud. Because what the Talmud was a bunch of authorities sitting around for hundreds of years in different places and at different times, sitting around thinking up the most extreme cases that the law, that the written law did not provide sufficient guidance to cover, right? And so the idea was, what if your oxen, you know, jumped in a tree? Like, do you have to pay the tree owner for the damage done to his branches? Does the tree owner then own the oxen? You know, and then they debate it, and they don't necessarily come to any resolution. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And that, you know, the only way to solve something like this is what, you know, is like the Talmud. Like, we are pushing the limits of what it means to be human. You know, here
well,
and the technology.
I mean, it's not fair to say we aren't having the debate about genetic engineering of children and multiple.
Yeah, but the debate goes nowhere. The debate goes absolutely nowhere because
well, that's kind of Talmudic too. I mean, it's not like we're reaching a conclusion,
right? But I mean, no. When I say the debate goes nowhere, I mean that that which can be done is done, and you know, a lot of law is about making sure that which can be done isn't done, because it has deleterious social, political, and moral consequences. You know, that you can drive a car 200 miles an hour, but we don't let you because what you do may affect, it's not only that you could injure yourself, which we aren't happy about, but who knows what you could do to other people. Theoretically, you could drive your car 200 miles an hour and not kill somebody else, but you might, and therefore better that you are restrained from your impulse to do that by the law, so that, you know, it becomes second nature that you don't do it anyway, right? So I'm saying here, every 5 minutes we have these terrible things going. And, you know, I remember when adoption, which was always closed, people started going to the courts to force an opening. And they used this argument, which is, I didn't agree, you know. There's a legal contract between, you know, my mother or my parents and this adoption agency. I'm not a party to that contract. I'm 22 years old. I should be able to go in and find out who that person is. And it doesn't matter that the logic of closed adoption, which is you are tampering with this phenomenon of people who are willing to build a family that is not simply created by, you know, genetic matching. They're willing to do it in this other way. And then when all that stuff became open, I mean, I don't know, now it's open and I know people who are happy to have found their biological parents and people who are very unhappy to have found their biological parents. Have we somehow advanced as a civilization because we've made this sort of forced this opening? I don't think so. I think it's another way of kind of fraying family bonds by making people feel like, you know, family isn't about responsibility. It's just about genetic connection. You know, I don't know.
The interesting thing is that, you know, this is a particularly tough issue if you're a free market conservative, right? Because the whole fertility industry is unregulated in this country. Surrogacy relationships, for example, which also raise a ton of ethical questions, those are unregulated. And because we believe in individual autonomy and a person's right to decide their own reproductive fate and to pursue, if they have the means to do so, to pursue that to the best of their ability. So we don't place limits, for example, on the number of IVF cycles a couple can pursue or things of this nature. But the question, especially as we, Noah alluded to some of the gene editing questions that are coming around and due to CRISPR and other techniques, I think we are going to have to start thinking about an oversight mechanism. It doesn't have to be federal regulation, but some sort of oversight mechanism, such as the one that already exists in hospitals with institutional review boards, for example, where people can bring these tough cases before experts who could judge the long-term consequences, hopefully, and ideally bring an ethical perspective rather than just simply a focus on individual autonomy and affordability.
That perhaps,
That
pivots a little bit to something that we should probably touch on before the podcast ends, which is the furor that erupted over the comments made by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam responding to some proposed legislation involving the ethical oversight of the live of birth abortion. I'm not sure what you would call it. Just infanticide.
Well, that was a Talmudic question, right? So there was the Virginia House of Delegates took up a late term abortion bill about loosening the restrictions on late term abortion, right? That
those restrictions being multiple physicians overseeing this, right. Approving of this pathway for a woman who has a child that is born alive that is viable. Maybe, but is also suffers from severe defects and a variety of other hypothetical conditions.
So the situation we're in is this, right? So late-term abortion has been controversial, you know, from the get-go, and a lot of states, including New York, which just overturned this, limited abortions to 24 weeks and beyond, and that has been supported, oddly enough, by again medical advances, right? That we now know that it is very possible for a baby born at 25, 26, 27 weeks to survive, albeit possibly with, you know, difficulties later in life, but that something that 20 years ago would have been science fictional, which is that a baby that somehow emerged from the womb at 24 weeks could become a living, breathing human being to live a full life. Therefore, it would seem that you would want to kind of keep abortion restrictions limited because it was never the idea that you should be able to kill a viable life with abortion. It was that the life, part of the whole thing was if you accept that it was life, it was not viable anyway. And therefore, you know, you could believe that it was ensouled and all of that and even in pain. But if it couldn't survive outside the womb, it still was in this weird moral legal condition in which it was an entirely dependent creature on the mother, and therefore it was part of the mother's body and the mother could do what they wanted. The decision to overhaul that and to make a partial birth abortion more acceptable or legal, or late term abortion more acceptable and legal, would seem to fly in the face of this remarkable development in human medicine. And yet this is the logic of the, I think, Christine, you mentioned, not the free market concern, I don't know what you call it, sort of libertarian, the radical libertarian view of the female body that is part of the pro-abortion movement, right? Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, this is a holistic thing, that the woman's body is hers, and there is no any in violation of her choices relating to her body. And then Northam said this thing, which was the Talmudic question that was posed to him, right? Which is, what if the baby is born alive for some reason in the course of this process that is actually done to kill it? What if the baby is born alive? And basically he said, well, the baby will sit there. And if the mother says, okay, that's fine, then we'll resuscitate the baby and the baby can live. Otherwise, the baby will be left to die.
Well,
that's literally what he said.
Of this controversy, because it's based around an actual legislation, and the sponsor of the legislation was undergoing questioning at committee. And so we have a little bit more details to the effect of what this would entail.
Yeah, because Kathy Tran is the Virginia legislator who was proposing this, and she was asked, well, you know, what are the limits of this? In other words, and she was asked, if the mother is on the verge of giving birth and then declares that she wants an abortion, would the law that you propose allow that? And she hemmed and hawed and tried to avoid it, and then the question was put to her more directly, and she said yes, it would allow that. So the question I think that that Northam was responding to came out of that. So he responded that yes, the baby would be, you know, as I mentioned, I wrote a blog post about it yesterday, and in all such cases, when people talk about monstrous things in sort of very plain, harmless language, it magnifies the horror, right, of it. And that's sort of what he unwittingly did. He said, yes, the baby, the infant, he said, will be kept comfortable while this sort of, you know, this discussion over whether or not to kill it is being had. Now, well, this goes, I just want to say one more point, yeah, John. This goes right back to your point about Jewish law, of course, because with the advent of Judaism was the end of child sacrifice.
That's right. The central fact that separated Jews from the tribes of the Middle East and was the great advance of monotheism was the idea that you do not have sex with children and you don't kill children to appease the gods.
Right.
Well, and also the whole point of asking all of these questions, no matter how extreme, in advance, is that you don't end up where we are today, which is, look, I've given birth. I wouldn't want to have to answer that question at the moment of giving birth. I mean, they're putting a burden on women. Like, really? You're going to, no, do you want your kid to live or die? I mean, thumbs up or thumbs down? What is this? This is not the way to run a civilized society.
It's we stand in you know, my wife has given birth 3 times. I stand in awe of her is all I can say having been witness. And I think so, Christine, we thank you for your service to humanity is all I can say. But I the thing that is so horrifying, I mean, the thing that's interesting about whether or not the Democrats have opened themselves up to an unwitting culture war point that they won't win, is that if you look at polling is has been pretty consistent on this forever, which is to say about 25% of people believe in abortion under believe in the right to abortion under all circumstances. About 25% believe that abortion should be illegal in all circumstances, and everybody else is kind of in the middle. So 50% are kind of in the middle. And this is the thing that there is very little debate about once you lay out the contours to people, which is, should a baby, should it be okay for a mother to abort a baby at 36 weeks? You know, mm-hmm. when your child might have been born at 36 weeks. People don't, this is, you know, I mean, Barbara Boxer faced with the same question 10 years ago. Somebody said, well, when is the baby, you know, when do we consider a baby alive? And she said, when it comes home from the hospital.
Jeez.
Now think about that. So is that a view that the American people or that, you know, or that the less politically engaged and less focused are going to be comfortable with? Is this New York abortion law something that people are going to be comfortable with? Now, the fact is that the horrors of full-term abortion or partial birth abortion are literally buried by the mainstream press, which is, I think, functionally pro-abortion in all circumstances, such that the most horrible story of the past decade in America, maybe the most horrible story, the death clinic of Kermit Gosnell in Philadelphia, who was, you know, convicted in 7 counts of murder, of where there were like fetuses kept in, you know, mason jars and stuff like that. Nurses talking about the horrors of seeing these babies born alive and then having their spines, you know, literally snipped to kill them. That should have been the biggest story in America in the year that the trial was. And, you know, you barely read about it because there is a conscious media blackout on this. So maybe it won't be a political problem because the press will not allow it. I did notice that, like, last night on Fox, much of Bret Baier's show was dedicated to this on Fox, and CNN and MSNBC didn't talk about it at all. So, I don't know. But I just think, you know...
We have to wait for see what Howard Schultz says.
And with that, we bring this show to a close. So, for Noah Rothman, Abe Greenwald, and Christine Rosen, I am John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.